he didn't know how to deal well with loss outside the context of war. Pogo said, "There's a bunch of Robert Faulkners, but in a quick search, none of them with that middle name." Helena Berg. Pogo came back to him quickly on that one. "It's a pen name. She wrote one book under it, her first novel, something called Out of the Mouth of the Dragon."
"Whose pen name?"
The smartphone was the planet in Pogo's hand, which billions of advertising dollars and the wisdom of uncountable pundits had assured him was tech magic, the only true magic. But when he looked up, his eyes seemed to see, and his face to reflect, the wonder of a witness to otherworldly mystery that, luminous and melodic, had just entered the comparatively dim and discordant world of high tech.
"Helena Berg was a pen name for Toba Ringelbaum."
As a girl, Toba had escaped the Jewish ghetto of Theresienstadt, where her mother died in a typhoid epidemic. Later, she survived as well the Auschwitz death camp, where her father perished. Decades after marrying Max Klein and emigrating to the U.S., she'd written a series of young adult novels about a school for girls, Valiant Academy, where the multi-talented headmistress was an adventurer and master of martial arts, who not only educated her charges, but also led them on thrilling missions against villains who represented one face or another of the hydra-headed evil that was totalitarianism. Pax knew all that because he knew Toba Ringelbaum. He had met her twice in Bibi's company. Pogo knew the old woman even better, having visited her often with Bibi. Bibi had found the Valiant Girl series when she was 10, and had read and reread the novels through her teens. In the notebook, her handwriting seemed almost to glow. "When I saw her yesterday, why didn't I ask Helena Berg if she'd heard of Robert Warren Faulkner? Is he a known neo-Nazi?" That question gave rise to another one in Paxton's mind. Why would she refer to her friend and mentor, Toba Ringelbaum, by the writer's pen name?
"I'll call Toba," said Pogo, "if you want to go there."
"Oh, I want to go there, all right," Peck said. "But come on, let's roll. I'll call her from the car."
Chapter 112, Teacher of the Year Award. In the headlight-silvered fog, which slowly but deliberately spiraled like galaxies in formation, Mrs. Hoflein-Vorschach stood within a pocket of clear air, as in one school of religious painting a saint always stood, or levitated, within a shining nimbus. Judging by all the available evidence, the former English teacher was no more saint-like than a worm, and in fact the worm had the moral advantage of not knowing the difference between right and wrong. The "we" in her threat. "We can take you down and break you down so completely, no one could ever put you together again, and we will." Put her in Terezin's neo-Nazi cult, and eliminated any chance that the selection of her husband as the builder of Terezin Inc.'s new headquarters had been a coincidence. "Where's the girl?" Phoebe asked. "Where are they holding her?"
"As if I'd tell you."
"Tell me."
"As if you need me to tell you."
"Does that mean something?"
"You know."
"Don't riddle me."
"Don't make me a riddle."
Bibi raised the pistol in her right hand.
"Gidget breaks bad," said Hoflein
Vorschach. "By God, I will," Bibi said. "I'll shoot you." She didn't know whether or not she meant the threat. Earlier, she had stabbed the brute who beat her and tried to rape her, stabbed him to death. But that had been in desperation. And he'd been a stranger. It would be harder to kill someone she knew, even someone like this awful woman. Familiarity bred contempt, but it also bred civility, even if a reluctant civility. Hoflein Vorschach's face was a nest of snaky emotions. Venomous contempt, hatred, arrogance.
She ventured no closer, although her posture was belligerent. You want to know something, you silly little goob, you ignorant spleet?
Never before had the former teacher used surfer lingo.
You've got this all wrong. You aren't putting it together right. If I was still teaching school and you were still in my class, I'd give you a D on this, and that would be a generous grade.
Bibi took the pistol in a two-hand grip. Where is Ashley Bell?
You think you understand Bobby Faulkner, the mother killer? You think you've got his psychology down pat? You have a handle on his Terezine ID and the cult he's building? Gidget, you don't know shit.
You're pathetic. It's not a cult. It never was a cult. Not anything as cliched as a cult. Bibi's hair frizzed in the fog, but in the bubble of clean air that Hoflein Vorschach occupied, her tumbling blonde tresses looked worthy of a shampoo conditioner.
Look around you, Bibi.
She made the name sound positively cartoonish.
Look around, and maybe you'll notice your cult has morphed into some kind of giant conglomerate that's building an uber-expensive headquarters in the campus style. Maybe you'll realize there must be thousands of people involved in this operation, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Does that make any sense for a crackpot Nazi cult?
We're not crackpots, Gidget. But you are fascists.
Everyone's a fascist these days, sweetie. The word has no power to sting anymore. The country has embraced all the fascist dictators we once shunned, kissed and made up. It's respectable now. It's the true and preferred way.
Bibi raised the pistol, aiming it not at the woman's chest any longer, but at her face, from a distance of 6 or 7 feet. From Hoflein Vorschach's perspective, the muzzle must look like a black hole with a planet-rending gravity.
Where are they holding the girl? I'm not going to ask you again.
Good. You're not going to ask again. I'm tired of listening to you ask. All of her life, Bibi had kept a governor on her anger, had consciously negotiated between the gracious, complacent aspect of her nature and the darker part of herself that sometimes wanted to strike out, strike back. Her tendency to arbitrate herself into a courteous reaction, or at least one of quiet anger, was motivated not by a noble inclination, but by fear that she would lose control of herself. She suspected that, should she lose control, she had the capacity to do great damage out of proportion to the offense she had suffered, though no evidence, either internal or external, existed to support that suspicion.
Where is Ashley? She demanded.
A bark of laughter escaped Hoflein Vorschach.
You just asked again!
You said you wouldn't ask again, and you just did.
Listen, Gidget. You don't need that little Jewess. You never have needed her. Don't you know a red herring when you see one? When you have actually dragged it across the trail yourself?
Bibi was building toward rage. She loathed this woman. Marissa Hoflein had been a bad teacher. She would never in 1,000 years have won any organization's Teacher of the Year award. And now she was doing an equally bad job of being a wealthy wife, utterly without gratitude for the grace that had befallen her, transformed by money into an ogre of privilege and self-satisfaction. And she wouldn't stop talking. If she kept talking, she was going to spoil everything. If she kept talking, she was going to say something that Bibi didn't want to hear.
You don't need the little Jewess, Gidget. Just do what you need to do. Confront the terrible truth. Accept what you need to accept about yourself. Know yourself.
And then do the deed that needs to be done. Hoflein Vorschach's face was such a portrait of self-righteous satisfaction that Bibi wanted to hit her. Hard. Again and again. Shut her up. Kill her. But it would be murder, not killing. There was a difference. The anger that Bibi had long dreaded to express, swollen now to rage, was a consequence of repressed fear.
She understood that much at last. Captain's memory trick didn't, in fact, burn away traumatic experiences. It flushed them down a deep memory hole where they, and the fear associated with them, festered in the dark. For 17 years, the fear had been at a low boil, until it became a thick and bitter reduction of fear, became enduring terror, became a suppressed anxiety laced with helpless foreboding.
"Know yourself, Gidget," Hoffline Vorschach repeated.
"Shut up."
"Learn your secrets." "Shut up, shut up, shut up."
The former teacher said, "You know I'm right, Gidget. He asked you what you needed most, and you said to forget. But what you needed most back then wasn't to forget. And it's not what you need now." Chapter 113. What Words Cannot Describe. The Spanish Colonial Revival House, with its many charms, the hallways and rooms fortified with books, the kitchen table around which more conversations had been held than meals had been eaten, Toba's gentle and winsome face, her generous smile, her unfailing kindness. This was a pleasing place, comforting to mind and heart. But at this moment, Pax had neither the capacity to be comforted nor the time to allow the house and the singular old woman to work their magic. Their hostess offered tea or coffee, both of which she brewed after Pax had called to ask if they might pay a visit. But he and Pogo declined. When Toba heard about Bibi's brain cancer and her collapse into coma 4 days earlier, she poured her full mug of tea into the kitchen sink, replaced it with coffee, and spiked the coffee with both Bailey's Irish cream and bourbon. She did all that before she could speak a word in response to the news. And when she was able to talk, there was a tremor in her voice that wasn't characteristic.
"I rarely drink. But there are times when even drinking too much is not enough."
The rest of what they had to tell her regarding the strangeness of Bibi's condition, the unprecedented brainwaves, the injuries to her face that appeared without apparent cause, though for the moment they said nothing of the tattoo, didn't lift Toba's spirits, but did engage her imagination and energize her. They told her about Jasper and Olaf and the long-hidden dog collar, about the reason that Dr. St. Croix had driven Bibi out of the university writing program. Although Pax had brought the notebook decorated with Pogo's drawing, they didn't at once mention the lines that had appeared on its pages as though written by a ghost. This wasn't an interrogation, Toba being on their side, on Bibi's side. But certain techniques of an interrogator were of use in an informal interview, and even in casual conversation. Whether you were talking to an enemy combatant or to a friend, information drawn out in stages, in layers, tended to be more detailed, included more useful revelations. Not because the subject was purposefully withholding information, simply, the human brain didn't always know everything it knew, needed time for one thought to tease out another, to untie the many little knots in memory and recover an experience to its fullest. When they implied that Bibi had spoken the words, "I am a valiant girl," in her coma, Toba sprang up from her kitchen chair as if 60 years had fallen from her flesh and bones.
"She loved those books. She was so industrious about finding my unlisted phone number, amazingly determined for a girl of just 14. She called and apologized for calling, for snooping out the number. Come now, you two, come along. Let me show you. Well, Pogo has seen it, but you haven't, Paxton. My study, where I wrote, where I write."
As they followed her along the ground floor hall and its shelves of precisely ordered books, lovingly maintained, dust-free, up the open stairs to the second floor and to her office, Toba said,
"You see, the Valiant series earned a comfortable living, but they were never bestsellers. I received some mail from readers, of course, but I was not besieged by little girls knocking on my door. I was flattered by the trouble Bibi had gone to, and charmed by our few minutes on the phone. So, I said she could visit with her mother, if she wished. A half hour. And bring 5 or 6 books to be signed. I'd never done a formal book signing. It seemed overreaching to me, too proud by half. Who was I, after all, but Toba Ringelbaum, who should have been dead 12 times? I wasn't Mr. Saul Bellow, though I might have wished to write so well. I found the girl enchanting, far too solemn for her age, and yet delighting in every smallest thing. A knowledge sponge in search of something that I think always eluded her, still eludes her, whatever it might be. That her office was book-lined came as no surprise. The large, ultra-modern, U-shaped desk wasn't the heavy-footed European antique that Pax expected. The latest model computer, with a screen that seemed the size of a billboard, as well as printers and a scanner and a tech geek's array of the latest electronic gadgets, proved that she remained in the game to an extent that Pax hadn't realized. And he was embarrassed now to have thought her largely retired, in spite of her claim to be still producing. Pogo said, "This is like a starship control station, Tobowan Kenobi. I've always known the Force was with you. Are you a dedicated social networker?" "Not much, dear. I have better ways to waste my time. Besides, I find social networking too antisocial for the most part. But I think it's wise to keep an eye on it." At a section of shelves devoted to the display of her novels, she had arranged the American editions of the Valiant books in the order of publication. There were 46 of them. "She calls me her inspiration and her mentor," Toba said. "And I might be vain enough to admit to the first, but not the second. How could I mentor a girl who, by the time she was 17 and out of high school, was already a better writer than I am, or ever could be?" "Maybe you mentored her in other ways," Pax said. "The values the girls learned at Valiant Academy. A lot of people these days might find those corny, or certainly out of date. But Bibi says the code of the Valiant girls is a brilliant expansion and application of natural law." Toba was clearly pleased to hear this, but then she must have thought of Bibi abed in a hospital, lost in a coma, for she raised her mug and took a long draught of the spiked coffee. "If there was one thing she might have found in the Valiant girls that she didn't already have, or didn't have in the fullest at 14, it was the wonderful concept of free will. She kept coming back to that in our conversations, that we are free to shape our own lives, that we can overcome, that there is a terrible danger in denying the existence of free will, the danger of deciding that we are meat machines, that all is meaningless, and that we have no responsibility for what happens because of what we do." Pogo said, "Should I tell her about the tattoo?" Pax nodded. The concept of 4 injected words appearing without the aid of ink or tattooist didn't startle Toba Ringelbaum or require her to stretch her belief system to any degree whatsoever. She had made no secret of the fact that during her time in Theresienstadt, and then when she had been freed from Auschwitz within hours of her scheduled execution, she'd had several experiences beyond explanation. When for a moment logic and the laws of nature were suspended in such a way that she was spared when she shouldn't have been. Some would label these events coincidence, which is a tool of fate, but others would call them miracles, which have no need of fate. She had never spoken of the specifics of those experiences, not even to her husband, Max, because they were sacred to her, and because she understood that the infelicities of language would diminish them. The ineffable would not be ineffable if it could be described.
When Pogo finished, Pax opened the Panther and Gazelle notebook to the page on which lines of Bibi's cursive script had appeared. And Toba listened without further need of spiked coffee as he explained how they had materialized and read them with her. Whether this was less or more astonishing than her indescribable experiences as a girl in the ghetto and in the death camp, he couldn't tell. However, he could see that they were of the same wondrous fabric, for she smiled and set her mug aside on the desk and said,
"It's not hopeless, then."
"Why?" Pax wondered. "Would she refer to you by your pen name, Helena Berg?"
"I don't know," Toba said. "It's peculiar, isn't it?"
"Who is Robert Warren Faulkner?"
"Never heard of him."
"Most important," Pogo said. "Who is Ashley Bell?"
Chapter 114. The Awful Woman and the Terrible Blow. The fog that Bibi drew into her lungs seemed for a moment to fill her head as well. Marissa Hoflein Vorschach had spoken about events of which she could know nothing. "He asked you what you needed most, and you said to forget. But what you needed most back then wasn't to forget, and it's not what you need now." She had never known the captain. He had died years before this awful woman had come into Bibi's life. Dressed expensively for a cheap nightclub, dressed for a production number in an old Elvis Presley film, with spike heels and toreador pants and all that cleavage and the black and white leather jacket, standing in a bubble of clarity in the white murk backlit by the Bentley, Miss Hoflein reinvented was demanding to be seen, to be considered and understood. Bibi thought she heard something behind her, someone closing on her, revealed by the crunch of gravel. She pivoted, sweeping the night with the gun, but she found no one. Lights in the construction office trailer, behind the window shades. Voices inside, less than half heard, unintelligible, perhaps not speaking English. Like voices from beyond, drawn to a séance, and issuing from a scrim of ectoplasm floating in the air.
"They haven't heard us," said Mrs. Hoflein Vorschach.
Bibi swung toward her former teacher, expecting to be assaulted in the turn, but the woman hadn't moved. Her look of triumph seemed to imply that she didn't need to attack Bibi physically, that she could destroy her with words.
"They haven't heard us, and won't," Hoflein Vorschach said. "Unless you want them to. You can always want them to."
Bibi still felt fogbound, mentally as well as physically, and even rage couldn't burn off the mists. Of all the ways she might have expected their confrontation to develop after Hoflein Vorschach emerged from the car, this was not one of them. At no other point in the past 2 days had she felt so confused, with so little control over events.
"What do you want, Gidget?"
Hoflein Vorschach asked with a note of exasperation.
"Huh? What do you really want?"
"Ashley Bell, damn it. Where are you keeping her?"
"Her location? That's just the next turn in the narrative." "What you want? Now, that's a bigger issue. Character motivation. If you're driven to save the girl, if that's your motivation, you first need to learn the full truth about yourself. If instead you're afraid of that truth, if you're the coward I think you are, then your motivation is to remain ignorant of it, and you'll never save anyone."
"Why are you going on like this?
What is this bullshit? We're not in a classroom. Aren't we?"
There was such conviction in her voice and such challenge in her eyes that it seemed as if walls might form around the two of them and rows of schoolroom desks appear.
"What do you want me to be, Gidget?"
"Want you to be?"
"As you know, I'll be whatever you want."
The fog was everywhere, deep and opaque,
everywhere except around Hoflein Vorschach. But she was speaking fog, a machine of obfuscation. "All you've ever been," Bibi said, "since my junior year, is an impediment. People don't change in a minute."
"So you want me to be an impediment? Prevent you from getting to Ashley? Prevent you from facing the truth?"
Surrealism had been woven through the past 2 days, but now its thread count seemed to be increasing rapidly. "You'll be what you are." Bibi didn't want this conversation. She wanted to end this encounter. In spite of spike heels and skin-tight pants and breasts that were the opposite of aerodynamic, Hoflein Vorschach moved fast, grabbing for the Sig Sauer with one hand, tearing at Bibi's blood-crusted ear with the other, missing with the first, scoring with the second. Bibi's cry of pain was silent, bitten off, choked down. As the teacher issued a zombie hiss through bared teeth, Bibi used the P226, but not as a firearm, as a bludgeon. Brought the barrel down hard into her assailant's forehead, which produced a cruel but discreet sound. Hoflein Vorschach dropped, sprawled face down, head turned to her left, lighted and shadowed by the Bentley's headlamps, in a strangely graceful pose, as if this were a macabre fashion ad in which the model was pretending to be the victim of a crime. She might have been unconscious or on her way out, but she regarded her former student with one gimlet eye that would have killed if the extreme voltage of hatred in it could have been emitted in the form of an electric current. Maybe Bibi should have waited to see if the eye closed and the woman remained still. The anger she had always been able to control now controlled her instead. She reversed her grip on the pistol, held it by the barrel, and brought the butt down on the side of Hoflein Vorschach's head. Not with full force, though still a terrible blow. Hard enough that the fierce eye disappeared behind a fluttering, but then stilled, eyelid. The violence equally thrilled and shamed Bibi. Made her feel empowered, though not exalted. If shame hadn't been part of it, she would have struck another blow, and another, until she'd seen the skull cave and the blonde hair darken with blood. But she retained control of herself, cranked shut the vent that would have released her fear-spawned rage in volcanic gouts. The voices in the construction trailer continued their muffled conversation, urgently scheming or merely garrulous, plotting the destruction of a city with a nuke or playing poker. It was impossible to tell which. If one of them was Vorschach, lucky husband, perhaps the other was Robert Warren Faulkner, alias Terezin. In which case, she could surprise him, walk in and shoot him dead, deny him his birthday celebration, and save the life of Ashley Bell. But would the leader of such a cult, such an enterprise, go anywhere without a couple of bodyguards? Unlikely. She couldn't know how many others might be in the trailer, stationed in rooms or a hallway into which she couldn't see from outside. She thought it better to explore the acreage under development rather than force an ill-conceived confrontation, just as it was better not to dwell on the strangeness of her encounter with Marissa Hoflein Vorschach and the bizarre way that it had ended. What is your motivation? To save Ashley Bell. Is it really? Yes, Ashley Bell. Save her or die trying. The fog enfolded her. Chapter 115. Toba's Life of Fact and Fiction. The old woman appeared not to suffer from arthritis, for she moved quickly and without complaint, and there were no thickened and distorted bones in her fingers, no swollen knuckles. She wore no eyeglasses, and Pax doubted that she had resorted to contacts. There was about her a general air of good health, as though she had suffered so much anguish and terror by the age of 11 that, when she'd been born out of Auschwitz, the exchequer angel that tracked the debts owed by every soul had excused her from paying any serious price for living well into her 80s.
She stepped past the collection of Valiant Girl novels in various languages to other shelves where she kept the young adult titles she had written outside that series. From the tightly packed volumes, she extracted the only book she'd written using the nom de plume Helena Berg. It was also her first published work under any name, Out of the Mouth of the Dragon. The jacket art depicted a stylized dragon with human skulls for eyes, but the image was poorly conceived and perhaps quickly executed, unappealing. Although the words, a novel, under the title, provided buyer guidance, the work might have been in any of several genres.
It sold poorly. A disaster. The package didn't say, buy me,
Toba noted.
But, in truth, I didn't have the skill to pull off the story I wanted to tell. It was meant to be a little journey through hell that would nevertheless be inspiring. The story of a young girl who survived Dachau, overcame the trauma, and built a meaningful life in America.
Your life, Pogo said.
Actually, no, dear. But it is fact-based fiction. It spins off from a true story about someone I met in this country after the war. Her name was Arlene Bloom. But of course, I changed it for the novel.
Scanning the front jacket flap, Pack said,
So the heroine's name is Ashley Bell.
Easier on the American ear, Toba explained.
Pogo was as straightforward as the white line on a highway and as easy to read as a roadside sign. His puzzlement was obvious.
The tattoo on Bibi's arm. Ashley Bell will live.
She did live,
but her name was Arlene Bloom.
Is the woman still alive?
Pax asked.
Sadly, no, Toba said. She died 4 years ago.
And Ashley Bell isn't really a person, Pogo said. She's a character in a novel. So why the tattoo?
After that first visit with her mother, Toba said, when she found out I'd written one novel as Helena Berg, Bibi insisted she had to read it. I told her the book was out of print, and for very good reason. My talent couldn't make good use of that kind of material. I found my métier in jolly adventure fiction for girls. But she charmed a copy out of me.
Not just adventure fiction for girls,
Pack said, because there was an 11-book series about a valiant academy for boys, which he had read when still living on the ranch with his family, long before the idea of becoming a SEAL had taken root in him.
It helped Bibi and me click on the first date. We both read Toba Ringelbaum.
Yes, she told me, and I was tickled. But the boy books didn't sell as well as the series for girls, I'm afraid. Otherwise, I would have written many more.
The graceful folds of her well-aged face conspired in an expression of sheer delight, and her brandy-colored eyes brightened.
I found it so very exhilarating to climb into the young male minds, to imagine boys being boys and kicking butt with rollicking good cheer.
Your girls kick butt too,
Pack said.
That's a big reason Bibi loves those stories.
Back to my question, Pogo said. Why the tattoo? Where is Bibi? What is she dreaming? Or not dreaming, but doing? How is Ashley Bell a part of it?
Toba,
Pack said as he returned out of the mouth of the dragon to her.
Any ideas?
There is one thing. One more strange thing.
After the old woman shelved that book, she took down another nearby volume.
I didn't have many extras of the American edition, so I gave this one to Bibi, the British version.
Instead of a dragon, the cover featured the face of a beautiful young girl of perhaps 12 or 13, pale blonde hair, complexion as smooth as bisque porcelain, remarkable violet eyes.
The wide-set eyes, which shone with intelligence, the direct and limpid stare, the planes and curves of the face, and the faint suggestion of defiance in the set of the mouth, seemed to reveal an appealing personality, as if in this case appearance and reality were the same.
Then Arlene Bloom read the manuscript of the novel, inspired by her life,
Toba explained.
The dear woman liked it more than she should have, considering I didn't do the greatest justice to it. She was always a lovely, generous person. Anyway, the British publisher wanted to have the face of Ashley Bell on the cover, instead of that horrid dragon. They meant to have an illustrator paint it. I'd seen this photo of Arlene when she was a girl, and I thought it perfect. She was agreeable to letting it be used. It was in black and white, of course, but the artist used it for reference and painted the cover in the photorealistic style. I'm sure this is the only reason the British edition sold so much better than the American.
She's kind of mesmerizing, Pogo said. Did she grow up to be this beautiful?
Yes, indeed. And her heart was more beautiful than her face. Like I said, 4 years she's been gone. I will always miss her.
As striking as it was, the portrait on the book jacket couldn't be considered strange. Pack said,
Toba, we were wondering how, but also why, Bibi might have gotten that tattoo. Why Ashley Bell is a part of this. And you said there was one more strange thing.
In the novel, Toba said, Ashley Bell survives Dachau, just as did Arlene Bloom, and comes to America, as did Arlene, and by the early 1970s becomes a successful and highly regarded surgeon, as did Arlene. My fiction was too beholden to fact. Modeled on Arlene, Ashley Bell in the novel is a surgical oncologist specializing in brain cancer.
Chapter 116, Reality and the Realtor. In the west, the sun settled toward the sea, and there were just enough clouds of varied textures to ensure, a quarter of an hour from now, the day would come to its end with a burning sky. As if melting, shadows elongated in the golden light, which would soon be red. At the window in room 456, Nancy looked down at the hospital parking lot and didn't like what she saw. Didn't like it at all, and turned away. The rows of parked cars reminded her of caskets, lined up the way that she had seen them on the news when men killed in war were sent home by the plane load. Murph had gone downstairs to the cafeteria to get sandwiches and pasta salads for dinner, which they would eat together in this room. Neither of them wanted to leave until visiting hours were over, and perhaps not even then. While Murph was getting their dinner, Nancy had decided to bail out of the real estate business, depending on what happened next. She loved selling houses, helping people who needed new homes, and she was good at it. Better at being a realtor than Murph was at selling surfboards, and he was pretty darned good. But if something happened to Bibi, not just the undefined something, face it, if she died, every property in the world would be, to Nancy, haunted. Every house she showed to every prospective buyer would have been a house where Bibi might have lived one day and raised a family with Pax. Every bare lot waiting for an architect to finish the house design would be a gravesite waiting for a headstone. Wrung like a rag in the hands of anxiety, this is what she told herself as she paced the room. Although it sounded as if she might be making a bargain with fate, she wasn't promising to give up her career if only Bibi were allowed to live. There was no point in such dickering. That kind of sentimental gesture made you feel a little better if you were feeling like crap, gave you a sense of control when, in fact, you had none. But it was meaningless. What would happen would happen. Fate was a bitch,
She made no bargains. What Nancy was really saying to herself, by planning to give up real estate sales, was that losing her daughter so young would surely drain the meaning from her work, her life. But you had to face reality, even when reality sucked. She was standing at the foot of the bed, watching the comatose girl, when dried blood and fresh blood flew from Bibi's damaged ear, spattered across the pillowcase, the sheets, as though an invisible presence had clawed open the crusted abrasions. Blood dribbled from them again. Chapter 117, The Tides of Night. For 100 feet or so, Bibi made her way through a whiteout worthy of an Arctic blizzard, a whiteout without wind or polar cold, but nonetheless disorienting and fearsome. When the lights of the construction trailer windows were hardly brighter than the phantom phosphorescence on a just-switched-off TV screen, she took her flashlight from an inside jacket pocket and dared to switch it on. If they had roaming security guards, she might be seen, but she couldn't worry about that. Intuition told her the threats she faced from this point wouldn't be as mundane as rent-a-cops. Since Pogo had brought the Honda to pet the cat, since she had set out on this quest, she had gone much farther than the miles on the odometer would attest. She felt as if she had traveled to an unknown country on an undiscovered continent, to the brink of a nameless abyss. There was the known world and the supernatural world that shadowed it, and the veil that had been deteriorating between them now began to dissolve entirely. Or maybe it was another veil rotting by the moment, a veil between her life as she believed it to have been and her life as it truly had been, between what she was and what she could be. The abyss on the brink of which she stood was the truth. Her body ached from the beating she had taken at the hands of the man she had killed, and her ear felt as if it were afire. She had left the Tylenol in the car. Didn't matter. The pain wouldn't incapacitate her. It focused her instead, sharpened her senses. The thick fog resisted the power of light, and the flashlight beam proved a feeble tool. The fog didn't only pool and eddy and creep, but also clung to surfaces in a way not fog-like. Within the general murk, thicker shrouds grew like moss on tool storage sheds, on pallets of concrete blocks and stacked crates of cobblestones. It draped backhoes and forklifts and other equipment like sheets thrown over furniture in a house closed for the season. She became aware of, or imagined, low, swift shapes paralleling her in the cloaking mist. They were pale gray and featureless, as low as dogs or bobcats, but they were neither of those animals, slinkier than dogs and larger than bobcats, larger also than coyotes, wolfish and elusive. She saw no eye shine, and if they were more than shadows of a threat conjured by her mind, they were as silent as spirits. The property would feel huge in broad daylight, but at night and in this murk, it seemed to be even more immense, a county unto itself. Bibi more sensed than saw the swooping forms of completed and half-finished buildings akin to those in the scale model in the construction trailer. Twice she came upon enormous cranes balanced by massive counterweights, their girdered booms vanishing high into the mist, like fossilized upright carcasses from the Jurassic period. She moved at a turtle's pace, and the farther east she went toward the back of the property, the more finished the project seemed to be, as if they had begun construction there and worked westward. At times, the compacted earth gave way to cobblestone paths, to plazas paved with limestone inlaid with patterns in quartzite and granite, glimpsed through the turbid, shifting mist. She circled the raised base of a fountain with a currently dry pool that must have been 50 feet in diameter, from the center of which rose what might have been, had the fog relented, a school of bronze dolphins leaping together, perhaps to spout water when the pool was filled and the pumps were started. Bibi began to feel as if she had lost her way in an amorphous maze,
that foiled her by continually alerting the route that would allow it to be successfully navigated. But then she saw lights ahead. They were faint at first, and curious, two measured series of large spheres, the first row perhaps 15 feet above the ground, the second row about 15 feet above the first. As they grew slowly brighter, she suspected that they weren't floating spheres, but were instead windows formed like portholes, each 6 or 7 feet in diameter. Her suspicion was confirmed when she drew close enough to make out the muntins that radiated from the center of each window and held the pie-shaped panes in place. Although she could at first perceive the structure's shape only by inference from the size and placement of the portholes, it had the feeling of a gargantuan vessel. She approached it with a shiver of wonder, as perhaps anyone in 1912 would have from dockside looked up with awe at the towering Titanic. Even within a few yards of the place, when she determined that it wasn't a vessel but a building, she couldn't discern more than a fraction of its details, though she sensed that it was longer than a football field, domed like an airplane hangar, and without windows on the ground floor. Walking alongside the structure, sliding a hand over the curved wall, she decided that it was skinned in metal, and she felt large, regularly placed exterior ribs forged of steel. By the time she reached one end of the building and found a flat wall, the wolfish stalkers, real or imagined, attended her in greater numbers, as though they had been trained especially to protect this special edifice to which Bibi now sought an entrance. They were shadows of shadows, surely immaterial, except now she heard subtle panting and the tick-click of claws on paving stones. She had the pistol in hand, wet with condensed fog and perhaps with Hoflein Vorschach's blood, but she had little faith that it would prove effective against the shadow horde, or even against one of them. A fuzzy reflection of the flashlight flared in a matte-finished steel door, about 5 feet wide and 8 tall, rounded at the top and protected by an overhanging cowl, medieval in spite of the material from which it had been crafted. There was no door handle or anything like a conventional keyhole, nor a slot into which she might insert a key card. The only possible lock release was a large oval hole in the wide steel frame encircling the door. Bibi stood defeated for a moment, but then remembered. From a pocket of her blazer, she withdrew the electronic key attached by a chain to the lucite fob in which a dead wasp took wing forever. Chapter 118. He can fix anything. Almost. The house in Cameo Highlands was to music what Toba Ringelbaum's house was to books. Ganesh Patel, surf legend and audio-video god, had designed, manufactured, and sold a lot of through-house music systems. But in his own home, he had a standalone system in every room. The issues were volume, clarity, and ideal reverberation, and he was always making improvements to his equipment setups. When Pax and Pogo stopped by to get the repaired tape recorder, the living room boomed with music Pax had never heard before. It was Hawaiian sway and steel guitar. It was rock and piano. It was tied together by backup harmony worthy of Motown, and the lead singer sounded like Elton John, if Elton had been born in Nashville and grown up listening to Johnny Cash. But it was good. Their host turned the music down just far enough that they didn't have to shout to hear one another. "This little puppy," Ganesh said, presenting the cassette recorder on the palm of his hand, "was sweet for its time. Plus it made you feel as sly and cool as a spy, how you could conceal it, a microphone that pulled from across the room. Even if you interviewed someone openly, with this puppy on the table, it felt clandestine." "Could we turn the music down a little more?" Pogo asked. Ganesh smiled and shook his head. "Not really." He was thin and dark and intense, perhaps as intense as his paternal grandfather, who, as a New Delhi street performer,
had tamed cobras with the usual flute, but also sometimes with just his hands, caressing them into a stupor at the risk of a lethal bite. Grandpa might or might not have been a snake charmer. He might or might not have stroked and tickled cobras into a trance with his bare hands. There were those who said that Ganesh had been born and raised in Boston, into a family that had run restaurants for 3 generations, and that the closest he had gotten to India was watching Bollywood musicals in his 12-seat home theater. With his thick black hair and lean good looks and large expressive eyes, Ganesh had all the success with women that he could handle. But he wasn't above tapping his cultural heritage, real and imagined, when he felt that the new beauty who attracted him would respond to an extra layer of exotic personal history. No one, not even the women, took offense at or disapproved of Ganesh's biographical elaborations, because he was unfailingly ebullient and entertaining and likable. "This old dude on the tape," he said. "Was he Bibi's uncle or something?"
"Her grandfather," Peck said. "Nancy's dad."
"Wow. More like Grandpa Munster than Grandpa Walton. Was he an alky or a serious mushroom eater or what?"
"He was a retired Marine," Peck said. "Never met him. He died before I showed up. But Bibi loved him."
"The music is really loud. Isn't it great? You can't help moving to it," Ganesh said, jiving in place. "You didn't say not to listen to the tape, so I listened."
"That's all right," Pogo said.
"I thought if it was a little damaged, I could do a transfer and clean up the sound. But it was clear. Clear and crazy. The old dude was flying on something, man, higher than JetBlue could ever take him. He totally creeped me out. I had to put on this music to stop the centipedes crawling through my blood. He must have creeped out Bibi, too. Although it doesn't seem to have screwed her up any. How is our radiant Kahahuna, by the way?"
Kahahuna was the mythological Hawaiian goddess of surfing, sand, and sun. Ganesh wasn't being jokey or ironic when he referred to Bibi as a surfing deity. Pax and Pogo had agreed not to broadcast Bibi's condition in the beach community, perhaps in acknowledgement of the dread they wouldn't otherwise discuss. They felt superstitiously that the more surfers who knew about her brain cancer and coma, the sooner she would die.
"She's good,"
Pax said, and Pogo said, "She's cool." Bobbing his head in agreement, but also to the music, Ganesh said,
"She's sassy. She's stylin'. For a while, I was in love with her from a distance. Maybe I still am. But I always knew I wasn't good enough for her. Are you good enough for her, Pax?"
"I'm gonna try to be."
"You better be."
"Thanks for this," Pax said, indicating the tape recorder in his hand. "Appreciate it."
"De nada," Ganesh said. "It was fun taking it apart and putting it back together. Just a knack. I can fix anything."
He tapped the recorder.
"Except, I couldn't have fixed Grandpa Marine. That old dude was a serious head case."
In the Honda once more, putting the key in the ignition but letting the engine rest, Pogo said,
"Grandpa Munster?"
"That's just Ganesh being Ganesh."
"I don't think so."
"We'll know in a minute."
Pax switched on the tape recorder. They had a good view of the sunset from Cameo Highlands, a magical Maxfield Parish blue for the base color of the sky, clouds on fire, orange and scarlet, blazing from San Clemente in the south to Long Beach in the north. The sun balanced on the sea, a fat, round bead of blood. Chapter 119, The Man Who Didn't Belong There. The electronic key fit the oval hole. The wasp in the lucite glowed like a lamp filament, and the pneumatic steel door whisked open. Because the chamber beyond the threshold had a high positive pressure, a gust of sanitized air blew across Bibi and chased the fog off her shoulders and back. As she stepped inside, none of the wolfish, shadowy stalkers lunged at her, which made her wonder if their purpose was to guard this building, or rather to herd her into it if she failed to enter of her own will.
Behind her, the door slid shut with a whoosh. She stood in what might have been a reception hall, one designed to intimidate or inspire awe. It was about 80 feet wide, 60 deep, 40 high, illuminated by adjustable pot lights recessed in the ceiling, most of which were directed straight down. Every surface was finished in panels of white quartz, which lacked the veining of marble and therefore presented a gleaming and uniform surface with depth. The only decoration appeared in the wall opposite the door, an inlaid 20-foot diameter disc of some blood-red stone, perhaps carnelian, which itself was inlaid with two parallel, highly stylized lightning bolts in black granite. Bibi recognized the lightning as being a version of the double S logo that had appeared on the front page of Das Schwarze Korps. Black Guard, the official newspaper of the Schutzstaffel, Hitler's chief instrument of terror. The colors of the Nazi flag were boldly represented in this enormous room, although reversed. Instead of red for the field, there was white. Instead of a white circle, red. Instead of a black swastika, the black double S motif. Whatever use might be intended for this building, Terezin had made only a minimal effort to disguise his inspiration. Perhaps that was because, here in the tumultuous second decade of the new century, frightening numbers of people were either easy to deceive or wished ardently to submit to any belief system, no matter how delusional, that reassured them and justified their hatreds. Bibi had fallen into a peculiar state of mind. She was afraid, but not of this building or anything in it. Not of Terezin, if he were waiting for her in some other room. She was afraid of herself, of some potential in herself that she had long denied, but that she might be unable to deny any longer. She didn't fear the bottled and stoppered anger that popped and spilled when she bludgeoned her former teacher with the pistol. Her rage and capacity for violent action were righteous rather than savage. Envy of others and hatred of others because of their race or creed or class were the source of the storms that sometimes destroyed entire civilizations. But they weren't the source of her anger. If she raged, it was against barbarism and cruelty, against willful ignorance and arrogance, against the demonizing of one's opposition and the brutalizing of the innocent. She could control even that potent anger born from 17 years of repressing fundamental knowledge of herself, which had left her with the fear of some act she had committed and might still commit, but with no knowledge of what the act had been. Besides rage, however, there was some other potential that she possessed, forgotten but not lost. It was coming back to her. In some way, the quest that she'd been on for 2 days was as much a search for that repressed truth as it was for Ashley Bell. The immense white, red, black chamber was unfurnished except for what might have been a reception desk, a great block of midnight black granite, so high that anyone manning it during an event would have to remain standing. As this object held the greatest interest, she moved toward it. When Bibi had closed to within a few yards of the desk, Chub Coy rose to his feet behind it. He held a taser. She had researched tasers for her novel. There was the thrust-and-click stun gun with no more range than the length of your arm, and there was the kind that fired two small probes trailing 15-foot wires. Coy was armed with the latter. He said, "Damn it all, woman. I don't belong here." Propelled by nitrogen gas, the wire whispered toward Bibi and the probes pierced her t-shirt. The shock mapped her peripheral nervous system and disrupted its messaging along both sensory and motor nerves. Racked by pain, without control of her limbs, she crumpled to the white quartz floor, stuttering a curse that her tongue could not complete. Chapter 120. The Hard Way. Bibi couldn't sharply focus on Chub Coy. She twitched in her private world of pain and motor nerve confusion, like some broken-back beetle in denial of its fractured shell. But she realized what he must be doing,
understood him well enough to know that he was coming around from behind the desk, not done with the taser, tossing aside the used cartridge, clicking another one into place. She had known him only a short while, but she knew his capacity for malice. She knew him well. Her expectation was at once fulfilled, as indigo light bloomed behind her eyes, and an alien current razored along radiant neural pathways, chattering her teeth, making her hands flop like the hands of a marionette operated by a drunk puppeteer. Coy circled as Bibi crabbed on the quartz, leaning toward her and raising his voice. Do you understand that I don't belong here? Do you get what I'm telling you? Are you going to stubbornly persist with this thread, the Chub Coy thread? Is the hard way the only way you can fumble yourself to enlightenment? Her eyes were full of tears, squeezed out of her by pain. Before her, the white quartz shimmered as if melting, as if it might have been composed of condensed and petrified fog that was about to return to vapor. Aside from Coy's shoes as he paced around and around her, the only dark object in view, approximately 10 feet away, must be her pistol. If she could get to the gun, she could use it. Pax had taught her how to use it. She was ready to use it now. No more hesitations. Use it not merely to intimidate, not as a bludgeon. Pull the trigger. Empty the magazine. Kill the bastard. So I'm a retired police detective, enjoying a second career as head of hospital security. That's logical. Sets me up as being maybe